Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Good to have you with us today. This hour, we're going to discuss all the joys of the holiday plus all the pressures of finals week. Two Muslim students will share their experiences celebrating Ramadan.
I have been doing iftar with my family a lot. It hasn't been as stressful it would have been during school time.
That's ahead on today's show, but first, at the state capitol in Lansing last night, Governor Gretchen Whitmer delivered her 8th and final State of the State address.
And of course, my fellow Michiganders, thank you for this opportunity. I start and end every day thinking about you. Because of you, the state of our state is strong. And because of you, I know it always will be. Big Gretch out.
I tell you, the woman knows how to work a crowd. Gretchen Whitmer has been at the helm for some very important moments in Michigan's recent history. Of course, our pandemic experience, our collective reckoning with police use of force, and some big changes in Michigan's finances, too. Michigan Public Political Director Zoe Clark joined morning host Doug Tribou for a look at Whitmer's speech and the Republican response.
What did you see as the top points Whitmer made in her speech?
Yeah, Doug, this was really a speech in two parts. The first was about the policy proposals that the governor laid out for the next year. It was very focused on what we know Americans and Michiganders are very focused on right now, which is affordability. She focused specifically in the address on creating more affordable housing and on the cost of healthcare and healthcare debt. Here's some of what she had to say on housing.
There are some common sense ways we can get this done. First, a new state-level affordable housing tax credit. There's already a federal affordable housing tax credit, which incentivizes the construction of housing for working-class families. And with a state credit, we can build thousands more homes every year.
She also spoke about her goal of increasing literacy rates among Michigan students, something that's really gained a lot of attention because of the low rates right now among Michigan students. She's previously said that literacy was something she was going to just be laser focused on this year.
Well, you called it a speech in two parts. What was the second part of her speech?
Yeah, that was really that this was about legacy. I mean, this was the governor's final State of the State address. And we should note, it's not just, 8 years that she spent as governor, but she was first elected to the State House of Representatives 25 years ago. So she spoke about what it meant basically to, be a public servant of Michigan for these past 2.5 decades. And she used the speech to really highlight what she obviously believes are the most impactful parts of her legacy. She talked about how abortion is now a constitutional right in Michigan and that there are increased LGBTQ+ protections. She talked, not surprisingly, about coming to a bipartisan deal last year to fix the roads, and then about repealing right to work. Michigan was the first state to do that in decades and decades.
Well, Zoe, you were at the Capitol for the address last night. What did Republicans have to say after the governor's speech?
I mean, not surprisingly, in a super partisan environment and in a divided Lansing, there wasn't a lot of lines in the speech that got Republican, clapping and ovations. There were a few, though. In fact, at one point, the governor actually thanked President Donald Trump. This was for the new fighter jet mission coming to Selfridge. But I spoke with Republican Speaker of the House Matt Hall after the speech, and he was reluctant to get behind Whitmer's policy proposals for the year that included any new revenue increases. I should also note, Doug, that when pressed multiple times, Hall would not commit to a bipartisan budget getting done in time for the July 1st statutory deadline. That's something we saw Lansing just blow past this past year as well.
Well, as you mentioned, you spoke to Speaker Matt Hall last night, and one of the things you talked with him about was a surprising proposal announcement that Hall made this week. Tell us about it.
Yeah, Speaker Hall shocked many in Lansing this week by proposing creating a sales tax for high-end services. This would be like a sales tax to, say, memberships to country clubs or marinas or things like limo rides. He says that would be to offset huge cuts to property taxes. He outlined that proposal last week. So again, we're going to see where these proposals all go in divided Lansing during this election year.
All right, Zoe, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Whitmer's not sleeping on her to-do list. She is embarking on a tour of Michigan to sell her plans following the State of the State address last night. She sat down with Michigan Public's Rick Pluta for a little one-on-one time about her priorities and what it was like to do her final State of the State speech in a very familiar setting.
You have 10 months left in office. Last night, you talked about affordable housing, healthcare, and literacy. In today's political climate and in a divided Lansing, how much do you think you can actually get done on your agenda this election year?
All of it, Rick. All of it. I'm not going to settle for anything less. Listen, people in Michigan need us to stay focused on the things that matter to them. And I know we've got a Republican House and a Democratic Senate. I know that it's an election year and rhetoric is hot coming out of Washington, D.C. But I also know this. The people of Michigan expect us to work hard, deliver on the things that they care about. And I selected three things that, number one, are important for the people of Michigan. Number two, are crucial for the economy of Michigan. And number three, are not inherently political. We should be able to find common ground around literacy and affordable housing and keeping healthcare affordable. I think every constituency in every part of the state would love for us to make ground on all three of those fronts. So I'm optimistic about our ability to do it.
What can you do as governor? What's within your power to enact this decreasing costs agenda that you're pushing?
Well, I think, you know, setting the agenda as I did, both in terms of the budget that I introduced a few weeks ago and the State of the State last night, marshaling the, you know, stakeholders to be strong advocates, meeting with and working with the legislative leaders and members of both houses of the legislature. I mean, that's what the job is. That's what I do every day. But I think looking at 10 months left to do, I want to be able to continue to deliver for the people of Michigan, even though I'm on my way out the door, the next governor will have to take up the mantle. I want to make sure Michigan's in as strong a position as we can be by the time that this calendar year ends.
So last night, Republican House Speaker Matt Hall said it will be up to Democrats to make sure that the next state budget gets done on time, unlike what happened last year. What do you say?
You know, the budget's done by both chambers and the governor coming to an agreement. And so it's on all of us, right? Every one of us has a role. Speaker of the House is one of three legs of the stool. The Senate majority leader is one, and I am the other. They've got to negotiate, and they've got to negotiate with me as well. So it doesn't rest on one group or another. It is divided government. We all have an important role to play.
You thanked President Trump in your address. Why?
Well, you know, the Selfridge, the work that we did to recapitalize Selfridge, it's really important for national security, for our defense ecosystem, for all the men and women who do work on that base. Under many administrations, our congressional delegation tried to get a commitment to recapitalize. I was able to get it done working with the members in our delegation and President Trump, and I thought that that was important to lift up. You know, I disagree with the president on, you know, probably 95% of the things that he champions, and yet if I can find common ground on something that benefits the people of Michigan, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to make sure to share credit.
Let's talk legacy. You went through a list of what you consider your accomplishments to be over the past 7+ years. What do you think your legacy as governor will be?
You know, it's always a funny question. I don't even know how to answer that. I can just tell you this. I'm not thinking a lot about legacy per se. I'm thinking about an agenda that improves the quality of life for the people of Michigan, strengthens our economy, helps people keep money in their pockets, We've delivered on a lot of good stuff that I highlighted last night, but it's a very real moment for a lot of folks in our state. They need us to continue the work. And so whether it is affordable housing or helping people with health care, we know that the cuts coming out of Washington, D.C. and the tariffs from the administration in Washington, D.C. have had a real hard impact on people, on our pocketbooks, and on our state in particular. And so we've got to do everything we can at the state level to mitigate that. And that's what I'll continue to stay focused on. And people will define the legacy in the coming years. But right now, that's not primary on my concern.
Governor, you delivered your speech from the rostrum of the State House where you started your political career, at least the elected portion of it. What was it like being up there and looking out at the room in that moment?
You know, it's bittersweet, Rick. I sat as a freshman legislator watching John Engler give his last two states of the state. I sat through all eight of Governor Granholm's and four of Governor Snyder's when my time in service overlapped with his. It was an honor to stand at the rostrum and give my speech last night. It also made me reflect on my dad, who I lost last month, and it was really hard. He was the one who encouraged me to learn about state government and apply for an internship in the House of Representatives when I was in college at Michigan State just down the road. So it was one of those moments that for me was about gratitude and the people of Michigan. It always center the work that I do, and my family drives me. So it was a bittersweet moment, but certainly I was pleased to be standing there and grateful to the people of Michigan for the opportunity.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer. She spoke with Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network. Time for us to take a break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with a Michigan college student who's part of the next cohort of Rhodes Scholars.
Really kind of like deeply emotional experience for me, because I think in those gardeners, I saw a lot in like the people that I grew up around.
She's coming right up. You're with Stateside. Every year, 32 students from all over the United States are chosen for the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship. It's a fully funded chance to study at the University of Oxford. Yumna Dagger is one of only two scholars from Michigan this year who are going to Oxford. As an undergrad at the University of Michigan, Yumna led the Sustainable Food Program, growing fresh produce for students through the campus farm. She graduated last May, and she's continuing sustainability leadership as a Dean's Fellow. A native of Dearborn, Yumna is hoping to give back to her Southeast Michigan community by studying environmental sustainability and the arts. Yumna Dagger, welcome to Stateside.
I'm so happy to be here.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Take us back. Where were you when you got the news?
Okay, so I remember this day very... I think I just remember it very specifically. It was at the Detroit Athletic Club. So they had, we were waiting. It was, I can't remember the exact number. I think it was around 15 other students across, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and West Virginia. So in the district that I ended up applying through, those were the states represented.
They gather all the candidates together in one place for the reveal?
Yeah, basically. And so it was all 15 of us, and the interviewers, they're kind of downstairs deliberating, and like we're just up cooped in the suite, just kind of anxiously awaiting. So I remember during those 3 hours, I remember throughout the entirety of like just waiting for it, I remember feeling just kind of like out of body a little bit withdrawn, because the culmination of like my work through this application, through the interview process, kind of felt like it was coming to a head. And like, I just got this sense that like, no matter what, my life was going to be changed, like when I left that room. So it was pretty anxiety inducing.
The work that you've done in your undergrad years, you've emphasized community in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. This will be a whole different, a whole different pond you'll be swimming in. Mm-hmm. How would you describe your experiences of community growing up in Dearborn?
I mean, Dearborn is, people in Dearborn, they often call it the Dearborn bubble. And mm-hmm. I remember feeling
I think my childhood and my growing up, like, I was, I wouldn't say the word is insulated, but, like, I've kind of felt like I was just in my own world.
In the sense of, like,
I guess
all your friends lived in Dearborn, all your family's friends lived in Dearborn.
Yeah, and I think it's, like, you know, I think growing up there, it's like you, when you leave, you kind of start to understand how much of it is kind of its own place. And I think growing up, like, I only knew people who came from kind of a really small subsect of the world who all believe the same thing.
I think this is one of the reasons that a lot of people choose to raise families in Dearborn, you know, is that they want shared values. They want people who've seen something of the world that's like what they've seen.
Yeah.
The sustainability work that you've done in Michigan, some of it has to do with food security and food sovereignty and food sustainability. Can you tell us a little bit about how you were drawn into, you know, just working with the land and trying to get people what they need?
Yeah. I think a lot of my early interactions with food systems were always just like kind of tangential to actual sustainable food itself. Like, I think I always had an interest in food. And I think even when I was young and I didn't have the words for it, I appreciated foodways as a way to connect and bring people together. And so when I came to Michigan, I recognized food as kind of like this constant nagging thread in my life. And I was like, well, I should just kind of go for it.
It's probably the universe trying to tell you something.
Yeah, I think it was some good redirection. And then I ended up applying for a job at the UM Sustainable Food Program. I was first culture manager there. And then I was program lead. I interned with Food Corps, which is a national nonprofit, and I worked, that was in partnership with the Ginsberg Center, and then I've done some other things. I think probably one of my favorite experiences was working at the Refugee Garden.
This is a project for where people who are newcomers to the country learn to grow their own food with what we have here in Michigan, people who are here in the country seeking refugee status. What kinds of things stood out to you in that experience?
I mean, I think, to me, I was there as an education intern primarily. So part of what I was tasked with was creating this culturally responsive land-based curriculum for refugee youth. But that took a while to kind of kick off initially. So what a lot of my work was just doing hands-on assistance with refugee gardeners, primarily from Syria. And I think it was such a special kind of like deeply emotional experience for me, because I think in those gardeners I saw a lot in like the people that I grew up around. A lot of what I was doing was kind of like doing direct translation, like trying to kind of like bridge the gap between like what their needs were to like my supervisors, and then also like seeing the way that they changed, the way that I change, the way that we all change in response to like working this small plot in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yeah.
It was kind of, it was a great experience.
A lot of courses in sustainability are talking about super huge macro things and concepts and systems, right? But sustainability is also a very small thing in just how we go about our lives.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you think people who study sustainability on that global basis might learn or might observe in Southeast Michigan if they looked at what goes on here?
I think one of the things that I think from our vantage point is we have a lot of cool, very community-driven work being done here. And I think what I see in that work is like the way that land can change people, the way that land can change communities, and in doing kind of these sort of land-based practices and in gardening, in being outside, in growing our own food, in sharing that food. It's how we're changed through those activities, how we deepen our relationships to each other in the land, how we develop a love for the place that we're from. And I mean, you have to think about both things. You have to think about the macro, but how do we get people to make smaller responses? How do we get people to become stewards in their own in their own right, we all have to kind of develop this practice of love for the places that we're from.
So it sounds like the whole juice of it is getting people to think smaller.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you first became interested in Oxford? I mean, being able to study, mm-hmm. you know, to get a full, you know, to get full yeah. scholarship at like one of the world's great universities sounds crazy. But what do you hope to find there?
I mean, I'm excited to continue kind of working on my own academic inquiry. I'm excited to bring the place that I'm from into global conversation, just because I think, kind of what you said, I think the world has to think smaller. We have to think smaller, and we have to reflect outward, in order to kind of begin catalyzing that level of change. I think that's one of the things that I'm particularly interested in bringing, is just bringing the sense of place, of bringing Michigan, Southeast Michigan, into global conversation. And I'm excited because I think it'll just allow me to just deepen those nodes more kind of intrinsically, and kind of perhaps return better fit, return refreshed and kind of ready to attack them here.
I mean, they're going to keep you pretty busy at Oxford, so it does seem like it's a good time to get the batteries yeah. recharged. If you're just joining us, my guest is Yamna Dagger. She's a graduate at the University of Michigan and a 2026 Rhodes Scholar, also a Michigan Dean's Fellow. Yamna, we haven't really asked much about your art practice, and I know that part of your plan at Oxford is to try to combine your studies a bit. Mm-hmm. Do you mind telling us a little bit about the work that you do in studio?
Yeah, I'm mainly a poet and a visual artist. I paint and I do, and I printmake as well. So those two things. But I've been kind of most of my art has been kind of carried by my writing practice, which I think is like maybe my 10 or 11 year anniversary of kind of like officially becoming of writing. Wow. When I was in high school, I was a part of this organization called Inside Out Literary Arts, which is a fantastic nonprofit based in Detroit. And I served on the youth council there for about a year or two.
What kinds of things have been coming up in your writing the past couple of years?
I think for me, the crux of, I did a senior thesis in creative writing, and the central themes that carried that body of work were kind of the intersections of food, place, memory, and futurity, of like building futurity. So
wow.
I think a lot of my own work over the past few years definitely kind of was like the upend of that entire project.
You're so integrated.
Yeah, I guess I am. Yeah.
Have you given any thought to maybe how, I mean, obviously these things combine in your life, mm-hmm. but do you think about maybe work you might do in the future where these things can all coexist together in some way?
I think so. I think the things that I most dream of are like places where art, culture, land-based practices and communities can intersect. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that I see like arts in my own environmental activism and the way that I go about doing this work is like art will not save me, but art can save some part of me. Art can be the thing that keeps me reflective, keeps me considering the way that I show up in this space, and it can be this speculative place where I can think of what will come and how I can be best prepared for that. So I think building places and building nodes of inquiry where those things can intersect feels salient for me, and it feels salient to the work that I want to accomplish.
What you said just pierced me about how art may not save me, but it can save a part of me. That feels very relevant in this moment, yeah. I have to say.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you think you're going to especially miss about Michigan while you're away?
Oh, gosh, so many things. I've been thinking about this. I'm gonna miss WCBN-FM.
That's where you work at the student station,
right? So I'm going to miss doing freeform. I'm going to miss, I'm trying to think of like food places I'm going to miss. I'm going to miss Detroit style pizza, Sicily's pizza in Detroit.
Sicily's. Oh.
So I'm going to miss, I'm going to miss Shatila. I'm going to miss
Dearborn's most famous bakery.
I'm going to miss my neighborhood walks. Michigan is just, it's just different. I don't know how else to describe it, but I know that it'll always, oh, I'm going to miss the lakes.
Yeah.
Of course.
They have some in England. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm not going to miss the weather.
I have some bad news for you about British winter, but let you find that out on your own.
Okay.
Yumna Dagger begins her studies this coming October 2026 at Oxford University, pursuing degrees in nature, society, and environmental governance, and in visual material and museum anthropology. Yumna, it's such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
In other stories we're following, automated license plate readers have been popping up on roadsides all over Michigan. They can record vital details about vehicles to help with police investigations. Proponents of the technology say that the cameras have helped to bring crime down. But as A.J. Jones from station WCMU reports, some Michiganders are concerned about what this means for civil liberties.
Cars whiz by in a busy intersection in downtown Saginaw. Each and every one of them is being tracked by four cameras on nearby light poles at the intersection of Court Street and South Michigan Avenue. The cameras are owned by the company Avigilon. These cameras don't just collect video, they are AI assisted. They can pick up details like license plates, damage on a bumper, and the make and model of a vehicle. One of the largest makers of these cameras is Flock Safety. Over 160 Michigan law agencies partner with them. Officers have praised the technology, saying it helps solve crimes other cameras can't catch. However, critics argue the data collected by the cameras could fall into the wrong hands and jeopardize privacy.
Meeting of the Bay City City Commission will come to order.
At a Bay City Commission meeting late last year, officials considered whether to retain the usage of Flock cameras in the city. Flock did not speak to us for this story, but company representative Trevor Chandler spoke at the November meeting. He said the technology is responsible for an over 40% drop in car theft in San Jose and increased arrests in San Francisco.
So not only are auto thefts going down, but for the ones that remain, the arrests for them are going up.
Local police departments have the option to share data with other agencies across America. Flock offers a nationwide lookup tool. Chandler insists that Flock does not own or sell the data they collect, and all data is purged after 30 days.
Every single agency, every single community that purchases Flock owns their own data, and they get to choose if they want to share.
Despite Flock's assurances that their data is secure, people in Bay City voiced concerns at the meeting.
No, I just don't want to give up any more liberties.
We could be putting money into better education systems, more things for the youth to do.
Flock can hand our data over to anyone, law enforcement, government officials, or private parties.
Those were Bay City residents Rick Mastrioni, Amanda Fenner, and Adam Reddick. There are now no more publicly operated cameras in Bay City because the commission voted to reject a new contract with Flock. As one city rejects the cameras, communities across Grand Traverse County are having a reckoning about them. The county has 27 Flock cameras. The company has contracts with three local communities. Over 150,000 cars have been detected in the last 30 days.
It's not just about it being a camera system to help fight crime. It's about a corporation or a company having access to all of this data.
That's Dakota Stebbins, a 31-year-old lifelong resident of Traverse City. After he posted a map of Flock cameras in the area onto a Facebook group, hundreds were outraged. Stebbins says he's concerned about the security of the data the cameras collect. Randy Fulis is the undersheriff for Grand Traverse County. He says Flock cameras have helped solve crimes they otherwise wouldn't have been able to solve.
You know, it's taking a picture of basically the back of your car. And unless that information needs to be accessed for some type of investigation, then that information is never accessed and basically is deleted after 30 days.
Fulis says the sheriff's department and Flock gave public presentations on how the cameras work, and there are policies in place to protect the data. He says the majority of the feedback has been positive. Michigan does not yet have laws regulating the usage of automated license plate readers. There is a bipartisan package of bills in the state Senate that would create rules for these cameras. They would require data to be deleted after 14 days unless there is an investigation. Flock and the ACLU have worked together to successfully push similar bills in Virginia. I'm AJ Jones.
Time for us to pause for just a moment. After that, what two Detroit high school students are asking of their school district during Ramadan.
Some days it is just so frustrating that you have to choose between like going to pray or going to class.
We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. We're about midway through Ramadan, and let's just say it, the whirl of the holiday can be a lot. But folks in the Muslim community still find ways to reach out. There's a group of students in Detroit Public Schools Community District who are inviting you to a free community iftar dinner at Chroma in Detroit this weekend. Now, part of their reason for inviting everyone is that they're trying to raise awareness for efforts to get accommodations for Muslim students who attend school in Detroit. Today we're talking to two students who go to Cass Tech and who are part of the organizing. Nafisa Tazreen is a junior, and Fatima Begum is in her sophomore year. Nafisa, Fatima, welcome to Stateside. Let's start out with just a little bit about what's going on this week at home and how you're celebrating. Fatima, do you want to go first? And then Nafisa, I'd love to hear from you as well.
You know, we're having like such a wonderful time with our families, like the joy of like eating iftar together or suhoor together and like praying and, you know, doing all those religious things that we're supposed to be doing, like without the pressure of like school, you know. And so like it has been amazing.
Right. You're on a seasonal break right now. So that's a happy thing that there's like, there's
but
a
like, it's
time.
Like I could focus on my religious obligation without like the school side, you know?
Yeah, sure. Nafisa, how about you? I mean, do you get to see family or friends that you normally wouldn't have time to get together with?
Yes. This Ramadan has been quite pleasant as it started during our midwinter break. On the first day of Ramadan, I did get to see my friends. I have been doing iftar with my family a lot. It hasn't been as stressful as it would have been during school time. And yeah, I really appreciate how I am able to help my family make food and get together, pray, and kind of have a spiritual moment together.
Right. What are some things about school that are hard during Ramadan?
The hardest part of being in school is maintaining our prayers. We do have a midday prayer, which happens to be during school. They do provide prayer rooms and some time for you to go pray. However, it is if you do go, you do miss a part of your class. That's why you have to, some days you can go and pray because it is not as important lessons happening in that specific class. However, some days it is just so frustrating that you have to choose between like going to pray or going to class. And especially during tests and quizzes, you have to choose your classes except going to prayer. So yeah, it is hard to maintain prayers. And then another harder thing is that since I go to Cass, it is a really tall building and you have to climb the stairs a lot. So during Ramadan, since we can't drink water during fasting, we have to climb the stairs. And after that, we are genuinely exhausted and we can't even drink water. So it gets really harder, especially during Ramadan. But other than that, there's not much difference between Ramadan and normal days of school. It is just the prayer obligations and the exhaustion that comes from climbing the stairs, obviously, because you're not eating.
Sure. Fatima, what's it like for you?
So everything Nafisa said, I agree with everything 100% because I go through similar things. But like for me during Ramadan and like alongside that, like school, the hardest part is like, you know, like you're fasting, like I'm fasting and I can't drink water. I can't have food for like a few hours. And then like, you know, on top of that, I have teachers who are like so on top of things. Even if they know you have a religious thing going on, they won't be lenient. Like they're just going to put more and more pressure on you, like for like, you know, for their work, to do their work and stuff. And like it gets hard because like especially at the end of Ramadan, because like that's when we you know, that's when like the hours, it gets longer, and like schoolwork, it like it usually does get longer, but like it takes time to do the schoolwork. Some teachers be giving us work that takes like 2-3 hours it gets so hard. And then like on top of that, we have Ramadan and like breaking our fast and all that. And so managing my time gets so like overwhelming for me during Ramadan. I think like that is like my main issue. And like another thing is that like my sleep schedule gets so messed up during Ramadan, but like what can I do?
Right. For sure. Because, I mean, people stay up late. They're really celebrating into the nighttime hours.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's celebrating. I think it's like, we break our fast around, like, right now we break our fast around 6, right? And then, like, after we break our fast, we kind of, like, you know, pray. And then, like, we take, like, a small, like, break. And then we start praying again. And it takes, like, another hour and a few minutes to do the other prayer. And then, like, imagine we had schoolwork, right? And, like, the teachers are giving us 4 or 5 hours of schoolwork to do. That would, like, take us until, like, midnight or, like, longer to finish. So that's, like, that is what gets me.
Yeah. Can I ask what year you guys are? Are you juniors?
I'm junior. Nafisa is sophomore.
Yeah, I remember junior year. Like, that's a tough year. There's a lot of hard academics that year.
Yeah, for sure. Me and Nafisa, we are in a lot of like extracurricular and like a lot of like clubs. And so like I think for me, I'm not gonna do like a lot of that during Ramadan, but like it gets really hard, especially if we stay for clubs and then like come home and then have iftar, and like it gets so overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Could one of you tell us about what it is that you're asking of the school district? What would you like them to do for students who are Muslim and are observing this month?
I would say to be more empathetic and lenient towards those students who are fasting. I know it would be a little bit too much to ask to be completely lenient for a whole month, as they do have curriculum requirements they have to meet by certain standards. So I would say maybe a little lenient towards the students, maybe be more empathetic and understanding, and not to be harsh on them because they are trying to manage their time and get their assignments done on time. And furthermore, I know that school has to continue going on for the month, and that is okay. But I would say to be more equitable to Muslim students, maybe give us a day off on Eid, which is the last celebratory day of Ramadan. When Ramadan ends, we celebrate on Eid, the last day. And it is something, for example, it is like Christmas. Families gather, we eat, we celebrate, we give gifts, and it is a really joyous time. So I would say at least like, you know, give us Eid off so we could celebrate with our family.
Mm-hmm. And Fatima, what responses have you received so far?
So, wait, like from the board?
Yeah.
So me and my friend, like I think a week from last week, I think, like last week or week before, we went to the board meeting and like we did a speech and like Vidi responded, well, not Vidi, but, yeah, well, Vidi and like the board, they responded with like,
the superintendent, Nikolai Vidi. Yeah.
yeah, they all like responded with like saying how like you know how Dearborn and Hamtramck, they have like they for a midwinter break they give students 2 days off, and during Eid they give students 3 days off, right? And so they want to they will take it into consideration and they'll think about it, they'll negotiate it, and then they might do the same for DPSCD schools. But like that's like that similar, that's what they said. Like last time when a student from MISD went to speak with the board, but like before they said that you know it's like not us who negotiate this, it's like other unions, you know, teachers union, DFT, this and that, like they also have to negotiate, right? So it's like going back and forth between the board and the teachers.
The teachers' union, right.
Yeah.
Well, my guests have been Nafisa Tasrin and Fatima Begum. They're both students at Cass Tech. I want to thank you both so much for talking with us about this and just really wishing you a joyous holiday this month.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to close out today's show with a salute to breakers of glass ceilings. After the historic victory of Mary Sheffield, elected as the first woman and the first Black woman to serve as mayor of Detroit, our colleagues at Michigan Public's Morning Edition have been thinking about other pioneering African American women in Michigan politics. Let's have Morning Edition host Doug Tribou take it from here.
In 1980, Lucille A. Watts made history when she became the first African-American woman elected to a circuit court in the state of Michigan. Judge Watts served on the Third Circuit Court in Wayne County for 14 years. Her work there helped open doors for both African-Americans and women in the court system. Watts died in 2018 at the age of 97. Joining me now for a look back at her groundbreaking career is another accomplished Michigan jurist. Judge Cynthia Stevens served as a district court judge, then served for about 25 years on the Third Circuit Court in Wayne County, where she worked with Lucille Watts. And Judge Stevens later joined the Michigan Court of Appeals until her retirement in 2022. Judge Stevens, good morning.
Good morning. And you forgot to mention that Judge Watts was a judge of the Court of Common Pleas before she became a judge of the Circuit Court. And in that regard, she was also a groundbreaker.
Well, when did you first meet Lucille Watts?
Gosh, I moved back to Michigan from Texas in the early 80s, and I met her through her being the chair of the Mary McLeod Bethune Association, which was an organization of African-American women who provided community services. And she was at that point its head and was providing free legal services. She was also a member of my sorority, Delta Sigma Theta. And so I saw her at sorority meetings.
What struck you about her when you started to become aware of her career and her accomplishments?
She was an individual who served and expected respect and demanded respect for others.
When Watts graduated from Detroit College of Law in 1962, women were not typically hired as attorneys, so she started her own firm. In an interview with the Detroit Free Press about a year before her death, Watts spoke about those early years of her legal career, and she said, quote, "At that time, being a woman was worse than being Black," unquote. Could you tell us some more about some of the barriers she faced as a Black woman in the legal profession?
So my dad graduated from DCL as well, and he had no trouble finding a job or getting some work. He was not treated like white men, but all the guys were over at the Tobin Building, and they all worked together. But both she and Jesse Slayton, another one of my sorors, had to figure out how to make it happen on their own. Jesse ended up being a legal secretary, which, as my mother would say, burned her biscuit. But she was 10 years ahead of Judge Watt. Judge Watt said, I don't think so. And I'm going to make it happen on my own. And she did.
In 1967, during the riots in Detroit, also known as the Detroit Uprising, Watts was practicing divorce and real estate law. How did she get involved in efforts to defend Black men who were wrongfully detained by police at that time?
She got involved because she interjected herself in it. George Crockett, the elder, who later became the rep, etc., decided that what he would do is he was going to hold court right there at 1300. 1300 was the police headquarters in Detroit, and people had been detained because they were, you know, walking while Black. She and a number of others, Elliot Hall, some other people that people may now know, provided these people with legal services.
After 20 years as an attorney in private practice, Watts ran a successful campaign in 1978, as you mentioned, to become a judge on the Common Pleas Court. Then 2 years later, in 1980, she ran for the Third Judicial Circuit Court. What was she like as a judge?
She was direct. She was thorough. But she was also a teacher. For those of us who were baby lawyers, baby judges, she gave us guidance, very much like her dear friend, Geraldine Bledsoe Ford. She'd call you back in chambers after you did something and tell you, maybe you don't want to do that again. Maybe you can do this a little differently.
In a conversation on the public television program, American Black Journal, Judge Watts described that in her early days on the court, judges were still pulling cases and picking and choosing what was assigned. I guess now there's a blind draw system, so that doesn't happen. But she mentioned being assigned particularly difficult technical cases. Were those kinds of obstacles common? And it seems like that was the kind of thing through research that she just rose to the occasion to.
I became a judge in 1981. And for example, I was a district court judge. And they intentionally gave me accosting and soliciting cases. In other words, the prostitution docket, to see if it would just freak me out. So yes, it was common. It was kind of ridiculous, but it was common. Mm.
You worked with Judge Watts in your early years on the bench. And as I mentioned, you served until just a few years ago. How have things changed for Black women judges in the time since your career began?
Well, there are many more women judges, many more Black women judges. Unfortunately, by the same token, the examination of Black women judges by the Judicial Tenure Commission has increased. We are more likely to be the subject of formal investigations. But as a general rule, the election process is much easier because the electorate is used to having women as judges. And that started with people like Judge Watts showing them that she could be simply the best.
Do you have a favorite memory of Judge Watts?
The day she swore me in as a circuit court judge and pointed out that common sense was uncommon.
Very true.
And Judge Watts loved to have people at her house. She was a great entertainer. But I do recall one of her soirees where George Clinton was there. And so while you may not think of Judge Watts and the Funkadelics, she had a wide breadth of experience and openness.
That was Judge Cynthia Stevens speaking with Morning Edition host Doug Tribou, remembering the life and career of Lucille Watts. She was the first African-American woman elected to a circuit court in Michigan. Judge Stevens spent more than three decades serving in Michigan courts, including 14 years on the State Court of Appeals, before she retired in 2022. That wraps it up for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow.